Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2014. Lecture 21, delivered on April 10, 2014. The title of this lecture is Dividends.
Today, dividends. We are quickly coming to the end of this beautiful rainbow that is called Our Time Together. And in these last few weeks, I will be cleaning up a few things that I have mentioned before. One of them is the practical side of dividends, and then the theory of dividends. And while theory has gotten a bad name among some people, the truth of the matter is that we really don't know exactly why dividends are issued. We know for specific what the reasons that company officials give are, but a comprehensive, this is why it happens, is not really available and probably never will be. There will be arguments all along the way. But here's the basic idea of and is there some reason this sucks? Okay. Here's the basic thing. First of all, I'm going to talk about cash dividends first. We'll talk about other kinds of dividends here in just a little bit. But first of all, cash dividends. A few formulas, and they're really easy, is first of all, your dividend payout ratio. And I've brought this one up before. Is nothing but the size of the total dividends issued divided by the net income of the company. In other words, it's the 1 minus the plowback ratio. It's how much, it's a percentage of your net income that you give back to the shareholders. And then there's another one that's actually a little more important. The payout ratio is important, but this one is more talked about, and you'll see it reported frequently by financial news services and financial reporting services. This is the dividend yield. The dividend yield is the current dividend divided by the price of the stock. So in other words, if I buy a stock for $10 and it pays, let's say, a 20-cent per share dividend, what essentially that dividend is doing is guaranteeing, or not guaranteeing, I shouldn't say that, is providing me a 2% return on my purchase. So the dividend yield is actually something like, well, this is sort of like the savings account part of my stock purchase. I'll be getting a 2% return on my investment in the stock. Okay, fair enough. But remember, as the price goes up, if the dividend stays the same, the yield is going to go down. And if the price of the stock goes down, if the dividend holds constant, then the dividend yield goes up. Now, a couple of terms, just to so you know, this is for basic business terminology. The declaration date on a dividend is the date that the board of directors declares the dividend is and what it's going to be. We shall be issuing a dividend for this quarter of 12 cents. If they do that on April the 10th, 2014, that is the declaration date of the dividend. Now, that's not the same as the date of record. Stocks are sold and bought all the time. So there has to be a stopping point. If you own the stock on this date, you will get a dividend. If you bought it after that date, you're not going to get this dividend. whoever had it on the whoever has it on this date of record. And that will be part of the declaration of the board of directors. There will be, we're going to give a dividend. And it will be applied to shareholders of record on such and such a date, which is probably a few days later, a month later. I don't know. It can vary. And so, as the date of record, the date of record approaches, you got a stock doing its usual ups and downs and ups and downs. What will happen as the date of record approaches? The stock's price will go up a nudge to reflect that dividend that will be there on the date of that will be available on the date of record. So, up to that date of record, there will be a little bump upward in the stock price to reflect the fact that if you buy the stock on or before that date, you get that little extra. And then you'll see a drop. And the price will go on its merry way after that date of record right there. This is called the price ex dividend. The price ex dividend. Now, as you're coming toward the date, probably right here is like the pure price of the stock, taking it not into account any dividend whatsoever. Any time before that, there will be a little bit of discounted value of that dividend embedded in the stock. And as the date of record approaches, that present value will get more and more closer and closer to the actual dividend itself. And it's usually a minor thing. It's not a huge thing. But it will be embedded back here for date of record people. I bought the stock a month ago. So the present value 1 month out of that dividend will be hiding in that stock price. And as that date of record approaches, that present value of that dividend will get closer and closer to the actual dividend itself. And then ex-dividend, you'll see a little bit of a drop, Blue. And you'll see that on stock charts all the time. What was that? The stock price just dropped right there like a straight line. Well, that just means it was ex-dividend. That's just ex-dividend. So, you know, it kind of adds a little complication to stock price analysis, but you can take that into account as you with certain programs, or you can just kind of ignore it, as a lot of us do, because usually the dividend is not a very big thing compared to the price of the stock. Here's the thing, though. Again, why would a company give a dividend? It's sort of like the company's admitting, we don't have anything to do with this money. You're my shareholder. I made $10 million. I'm going to give you $1 million dividend. Well, that's just telling me that apparently you know how to use that $1 million better than we do. We don't have anything to do with it. We can't think of anything to do with that extra million. That shouldn't be a good sign. That should be a bad sign for a company. So we've got to figure out why this would happen. If it's something that, you know, company giving away its money. Now, some companies have to. Remember I told you about those things called REITs, Real Estate Investment Trusts? They have to disgorge their net income, 95% of it, at the end of every year to keep their tax-free status. And there are other corporate structures that do that too. Also, I should point out something else, and I think I mentioned this earlier, but I'll bring it up again. Something that's kind of an annoyance is that in our corporate tax code, the federal tax code, there's actually a penalty if you don't pay a dividend under certain circumstances. I'm trying to remember what they call it. Something like inappropriate accumulation of retained earnings or something like that. In other words, you see, here's the deal. When you buy a stock for $10, you sell it for $15. The company has grown very nicely. You are taxed on that $5 differential, the capital gain, at a pretty low rate. But if I give you a dividend, that's just part of your ordinary income. That's taxed at a higher rate, your ordinary income rate. Some people, cynics, and I'm one of them, think that the whole deal is that they want to keep companies from accumulating all of their earnings and then using those to blow the stock price high They want some of that coming to you so that it can be taxed at a higher rate. Now, maybe that's not what they're doing, but it smells to me like there really couldn't be much of a better reason for it. And it's really, it's not going to do that much anyway. There are these companies right now, that these huge companies that have got so much money. They are giving dividends, but, I mean, they're still accumulating cash at just a staggering rate. And the amounts are huge. So we're talking about when you see companies like Google, Apple, and companies like that, and a lot of other ones that have got enormous amounts of cash, that probably is a good time to start looking at what could they want to do with that cash. They probably don't have enough projects internally to blow all that money, so that's when we start looking around for what they are looking at as far as takeovers go. It makes us curious. Well, you know, we're trying to read tea leaves. Where have the company officials been flying to? Can we get any inside word on what kinds of things they'd like to go into in the future? And it becomes sort of a fun thing to talk about and start to speculate if you could get in front and guess right on, for example, what Google is going to grab next, or what Berkshire Hathaway is going to grab next, or what Apple might go into. Then you could go and buy stock in the target and just bet that it was going to just pop in price as soon as the acquisition became public, knowing about the acquisition was public. So, for example, what's in the new, what do we talk about now? Who is vulnerable? Obviously, there are a lot of sharks out there with a whole lot of teeth called money. And so we're looking around for what would possibly be a target for an acquisition. They're all over the place. Anyone hear of any? Before I mention any, have you heard of any that might be on the meal plan for a company? No? Okay, let's talk. Twitter has shown up in conversations as being a target, a desirable target. Barnes & Noble has a very good value if they get rid of Nook. And so there's a lot of speculation that the price, current price of the stock, a bit north of $18, is going to be a better price once that company is on the auction block and someone grabs it who is going to just get rid of that giant dead weight called the Nook. There are other companies that are interesting, little companies, a few bigger ones. You're not going to see wars of giants, really. But there are still companies out there that are prospective for an acquisition. And then, of course, the question would be, why would a company just give away all of its money as dividends when it could get some of these really juicy targets, use its money for these juicy targets out there, and create more monopolies in this capitalist society? Okay, theory. Why are dividends being given? Here's one. This is called residual theory. You remember when I showed you that awful... Oh, by the way, I finally was able to reopen an alternative for Quiz 5. So go ahead. If you didn't get Quiz 5 done, take the alternative. It doesn't show up right in the grade book. I have to transfer the grades manually. But you remember in that marginal cost of capital exercise, they listed their projects that they were looking at for this year. And you rank them from in terms of the highest return on investment to the lowest return on investment. Well, there's something that I know personally, and the book brings this up, and we know is that some companies actually kind of do the process a little bit backward. They say, all right, if we have these projects, how much equity would we need in terms of actual cash dollars to be able to mix with our debt component in order to get through the projects that meet our marginal cost of capital goals, thresholds. So what they're doing is they're saying, all right, if we're going to need a total of $18 million to get through our projects, that we think are going to work. Okay, what that would mean is that we're 40% debt, 60% equity. Okay, $20 million in projects. So that would mean that we're going to borrow $8 million. We would need $12 million. Okay, our net income last year was $13 million. That means that we can jettison $1 million that we wouldn't be able to use because we don't have any projects that would work for that extra. You follow the idea? It's like the residue money that would not be useful to the company because it needs a little less in equity to mix with debt in order to fund all the projects that meet its desired goals, its targets. So whatever would be above the amount of equity in the debt equity mix, that you can declare as a dividend for your shareholders. A little complicated, and it's also a little bit suspicious too, because it gives more credit to companies for having consistency in their cash flows than a lot of companies do. You see, because one of the things that you don't want to do is, here's what I found out. When I was doing consulting, I had a couple of companies that were underway. They were well underway, and they were doing okay. And the shareholders were just bitching and bitching about getting a dividend. Okay. So the company said, okay, let's do a dividend here. And the first thing is, once you start giving a dividend, it's sort of like, yeah, you don't have to give a dividend if you don't want to. We could give a dividend this quarter and then say, we can't give a dividend next quarter. Bad, bad idea. You will get punished on stock price. Because once you start paying a dividend, your clientele of investors is going to get used to that dividend like instantly. Okay. I give you $20. Well, you're probably going to expect that I'm a sucker and I'm going to give you a $20 bill every now and then. Especially if I gave you a $20 bill this week and then 1 week later I gave you another $20 bill, you're going to begin to like those $20 bills and expect them. And I am a great guy. But if in the third week I don't give you that $20 bill, I'm an asshole. Even though, you know, I don't have to give you any money. You know, I'm just giving it to you because you've got cute buttocks. But, sir, ace. But yeah, you see, the thing, though, is that you begin to expect this out of me. And so I cautioned the directors in that company. I said, once you do this, you're right. Dividends, it's your discretion whether you give your shareholders a dividend or not. But they are going to consider it a bad thing if you stop doing it once you do it. That's the first thing. And then it's even a little worse than that. Because generally speaking, your shareholders are going to expect that not only do you continue doing dividends, but that you stay consistent with them. And in fact, in some manner, timely manner, you begin a growth path on the dividend. So if you, okay, well, we'll be able to give them a dividend, you know, pretty much every quarter. We've got our projections, and we'll be able to handle it. You know, it might not always be as big as this one. Well, there you go. Don't do that. There's your problem. Once you start it, not only should you continue it, but you should try to maintain a stability of the dividend and a growth path on the dividend. You see, the problem with residual theory is that, I mean, that would sort of imply that you're going to know what your cash flows are from 1 year to the next. You're going to know what projects are available, and you can plan in such a way that the residual is always going to be about the same on a per shareholder basis, or it's going to grow on a per shareholder basis, and that ain't how it's going to probably be. I mean, my cash flow goes up and down. If that thing had horns on it, I'd think I was at a rodeo. And a lot of companies like that are like that. This might be the right theory for an older, mature corporation that has smooth cash flows, and it can project better what residual would be there from year to year to year to year. Yeah, go ahead.
Who does dividends matter to most?
Oh. Give me a minute, because that's where I get to next. Is the next one is what's called the clientele theory. Now, what I'm trying to show you here is that there's probably a different reason, a different theory applying in different situations. Clientele theory posits that companies want to attract specific types of investors. Some companies want to bring in the big dogs, the sophisticated, the hardcore, the money managers. That's all they care about. Unfortunately, there are a lot of companies that actually do. And then there are other companies that really don't want that. I greatly admire this company, and I've spent time with them and visit up there in the Chicago area. And the executive officers and the board of directors, they are dead set against having Wall Street boys get their stock, get a hold of their stock. That worries them all the time that they are going to be noticed. And I even advise them on a couple of poison pills they're not going to be effective. If those boys want this, they'll just come and take it and they'll eat me for a snack and the company officials. But so far they've been off the radar because there's so many companies out there. But these company officials say, we want our investors to be more like common people, because we want that kind of person in our ken. And so what they will do is they'll have a more robust dividend policy so that there is more money in the hands of their shareholders. They get a check. You know, one of the company officials said, well, you know, we've got some older investors and they rely on that dividend check for some of their, at the end of every quarter, they know that they can take care of a few bills that they've put off, or they can buy something nice for themselves. And so we do that. So that's a clientele effect. That company wants to keep its dividend level good, and it wants to keep it growing because it wants a clientele of a specific kind. Whereas if you are one who is the butt boy of the Wall Street boys, they're going to tell you, don't be giving dividends. We don't need them. We don't want to have to roll that over. We want you to plow that money back in, grow, 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 plow back, plow back. And so if you want those people to own your stock, you would probably be aiming at a different clientele and therefore have a different dividend policy from the one that would be for a company that was a smaller, more modest company. Now, is this the way it always works? No. Although I will tell you that if you're in a company that's of any size whatsoever, large size, I mean, so many of these companies are just do whatever they're told by Wall Street. You know, mass layoffs, dividends zero or tiny dividends, invest in these projects instead of these projects, move your operations overseas and get rid of your employees here in the United States. They'll just do whatever the Wall Street boys say, because the Wall Street boys are the ones that buy the stock and keep the stock price up like this. Keep that stock price up there nice and robust. And why would the executives and the board of directors want that for the company? Well, because they have a lot of stock and stock options. So the higher the stock price is, compliments of Wall Street, the richer these executives get through their stock options in the company that they can leak out through Rule 144. Right? Okay. And it's kind of tying a little bit of the last lecture in here. Okay, there. Now, here's one. I think I already told you this story, but maybe I didn't, so. Signaling theory. Back in the early years when I was a consultant, I always had this idea that I would I have to get close to the insiders. I have to be with them, part of them, in order to begin to understand the company, the psychology of the company, and the ability of these insiders, the executives, to actually make this thing work and to get them to trust me enough that they might actually even listen to me. In some ways, that was a very bad mistake on my part, and I have regrets about it. But one year I was invited to a Christmas party of a very powerful firm. I got in that close, and so I was kind of like family. I was one of their consultants. And so I went to this, and the chief executive officer of the company, I mean, this was lavish. There was just this whole layout of lamb chops across an entire table, and there were wines of all kinds. There were all kinds of little snackies and desserts and dishes, and it was so incredible. And it was in this room that was only partially lit, had velvet curtains and covering the walls. Oh, it was awesome. The chief executive officer of the company got up there before all of the people who were assembled. And these were the top dogs of the company and people on the outside who had influence in the company or had something that they could do for the company. And the chief executive officer talked about what a great year it was and how fabulous the future looked for the company. And it was just a really upbeat thank you all for being a part of this company. And I just want you to have a wonderful time tonight and know that this company is here to stay. And the guy then took out a cigar, which was very expensive, and he put it in his mouth. And then, up to a candle, he took a $100 bill that he pulled out of his pocket, crisp $100 bill, rolled it and lit the $100 bill on the candle, and then lit his cigar with the burning $100 bill. I mean, it was just like something out of a stupid B movie, but he did it. I thought, I'm just sitting there. He's like, yeah, he went there. He actually went there. And, of course, I'm over there on the side, like that, you know. Why the hell would you burn a $100 bill? I mean, my God, why would you burn a $100 bill? Would you burn a $100 bill? It didn't look like you would. I mean, you look sane. What about you? Would you burn one? Why would these people, why did he do that? And it was, you know, nothing to these people. You know, they all just sat there. They thought that was pretty cool. Yeah. And, you know, like I said, you know, as soon as he threw that $100 bill in the ashtray, I was pounding that mother. But, you know, no. Okay. Why did he do it? Huh? No. He had an ego. Believe me, that man thought he could put down a lake and walk across it. But it wasn't ego at all. It was clearly a calculated move. Undoubtedly, huh? No. Why did he do it? Because he could. He was signaling everyone there that they were so well off that little things like $100 bills didn't matter. That is what we call signaling. Signaling is, in corporate affairs, the nonverbal methods a company uses to convey, communicate, or otherwise share its condition. To communicate, convey, or share its condition. That is, read that, financial condition. Woman, you found out that you are my long-lost daughter. And I am actually a very wealthy arms and drug dealer. I work with Vladimir Putin. Vlad, he's Vlad to me, but you know. And, you know, but how do you know that? I mean, people are whispering these things, but, you know, you look at me and you see, the first thing that comes to your mind is creep. I know that. I saw you look like that. And then I just walked by. I'm so glad you're back with me. Your mother was a tramp, but, I mean, you're different. Here you go. here, let's take this wad of $100 bills. Good girl. Yeah. And I walk off and I talk with other people there. Do you believe the stories now? See, you believe them more than you did when it was just rumors that I was a very wealthy, powerful person. When I gave you that, I signaled you that I could do that. I could. I gave you a nonverbal communication of my financial condition. And that's something that is actually kind of important in a corporation, because when we give out information to the public, as a public corporation, we are under strict rules about what we can say and what we can't say. But there are all these nonverbal ways that companies are constantly conveying information to the markets. You see, we want the markets to have perception of us, but sometimes we can't say what we want to say to them, so we have to do it in another way. A dividend that is a nice dividend is a way of saying to the markets, we're good, we're okay, we can disgorge a little money, it's not going to hurt us at all. We can give you money. And so in that way, it's a signal. Now, there are other signals that companies give too, and there are many times when you are really interested in what's called signal control management. Signal control management is making sure that the signals that you send are the ones you want to send, and you never send signals that you don't want to send. Hence, Mozilla made a big mistake and sent a signal that it just did not want to send last week. Well, actually, it started before that. Does anyone know what Mozilla, the company Mozilla, you know, famous for Firefox, did last week that got them in all kinds of trouble? Anyone know? Yeah. Yeah, and some statements he had made. It turns out that they did not vet that person well, and so it came out after they had put him in the CEO position, these donations and these things, I mean, some of this was rather dark stuff. Now, whether or not you are all into LGBT rights and all that, you don't step on the issue. That's not our issue. We don't care as a browser whether you are into monkeys or humans or whatever. That's not our job. And here we have a CEO holding up a signal, hey, I'm a homophobe, beep, 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 beep. So they got rid of him real quick because he had it was a stumble. There's a place closer to home here that you might have heard about where they hired a president of a school who... I like my job. I'll shut my ass. Wrong signal. Because this particular school, which will remain nameless, does not want the management noticed. They want their academics, their sports, and their community stuff, all of that, and their work with the business community and the arts community and all that, they want that to be the exclusive thing that is noticed. So they do not want signals being sent out that they have some time bomb that keeps popping off and barking at things on the payroll. Okay, and that's why when you go into a company, you might think, well, some of the things that they're looking at about me are just so unfair. Student here, not too long ago, he was considering himself a big, big leader, a real popular person. He was always putting motivational statements on Facebook and always showing up the volunteer. The self-nomination for leadership, which is unfortunate that they self-nominate because that's usually not the people you want. I'll lead this group or I'll lead this project. Well, on Facebook, he also had quite a few pictures of him on beaches twirling scantily clad women. And I wrote at one point on his Facebook page, because I had to have him as a friend because I was running a page for a group, I said, you need to get that picture down right now. And he came back, lol, why? Don't you ever lol my ass. God damn. But you see what he was doing? how hard it's going to be for him to get a job because he's a walking sexual harassment lawsuit. He's signaling, oh, yeah, hire me and I'll be doing this on the company time and then it'll be on Facebook and then our competitors are going to have a real party with us showing what kind of people we hire. Signaling is huge in the business world. No, we don't want to hire you. You've had 3 DUIs. We don't really want to do that because, you know, the next one you have on our company time, well, or you're on our payroll, well, that's going to be some negative research that our opponents can use against us. The same is true with politicians. We have the worst problem in the world with politicians because we want them to signal God, country, and family values and stability and pro-America, and sometimes we have one like the guy that just last week, family values, eats breakfast at the church on Sunday mornings. He was in a video having a passionate kiss with his biggest fundraiser's wife. Bad signal. Bad signal. One last one that I want to bring up. And there's one other one in the book. Don't even look at the Modigliani-Miller one. But this one is actually, this is called the bird in hand theory. The bird in hand theory is this idea, and it's actually old school. It's an old idea that management that is in an older tradition will say that our investors, yeah, they'd love to have the stock price go up. But, you know, if they had a choice, we think our investors, if they had a choice between the stock price popping up by a nice amount or them knowing that they're going to get a check in the mail with a for a dividend, well, they're going to choose a dividend because it's a bird in the hand. Who knows what stock prices are going to do? Stock prices go up and down. You have all of these theoreticians and these talking heads. Well, I think this stock price is going to go up nicely by 28%, 50%. They don't know jack. We don't. And we can't because stock prices follow random Brownian motion. They are what are called submartingales. You can't predict them. And so if you can give people something they can predict, they're going to take that over something that might happen, but that they can't predict. That's called bird in hand theory. Old school stuff. And I do know managers who follow this. Yeah, our stock price could go up or down, and we're going to work to make our stock price go up, but we can't guarantee that to our investors. But what we could guarantee is that we're going to keep a dividend as long as we can. We're going to grow it modestly so that they have a lot more certainty that they're going to get something out of this investment in this stock. And again, this isn't what all companies think, but I can tell you right now, I know some companies, the executives of some companies, older executives, that's how they think. Well, we're going to give a dividend because at least they know they're going to get something out of this investment buying the stock in this company. So there you are on that. Now I want to bring up a couple of things here that just have to be brought up. There are things that aren't, yeah, did you have a question?
Can you say again in layman's terms what the residual
is? I don't know if I can in layman's terms. That one's the most complicated. Let me try that one again on you, okay? Okay, suppose that a company is 40% debt and 60% equity, okay? Now, we've gone through these projects, and we've, you know, remember how we listed those projects in that, like that problem you did with the different housing developments? And suppose that we figured out that we're going to need a total of, let's say $15 million. Okay, let me do a simpler number, $60 million, okay? So that would mean that $16 million, oh God, what's 60% of $16 million? Huh?
I said just say $10 million.
No, I can't do that. I was trying to pick a damn easy number there. Huh? No, stop it. Let's do it this way. Let's say that they've made 20 mil, let me do it. let me do it this way so I can use numbers that actually work for me here. Okay. They have figured that they're going to need $20 million in money to cover the projects that came out above their marginal cost of capital. Okay, they're going to need $20 million for that. Now, if they are 40% debt, 60% capital is their optimal capital structure, that would mean that they are going to need $8 million in debt from banks, and they are going to need the rest, $12 million, in equity. Okay. Suppose that the company made $14 million at the net income level last year. Do you see that they could use only internally generated equity? They wouldn't have to sell new stock with the money that they've made. $14 million is going to cover $12 million. But there's going to be $2 million of residual that they don't have any use for. So that's a dividend. That's a residual theory. Essentially, companies that earn more than they'll need can spin that extra off. The argument against this theory is, you're telling me that you couldn't find anything to do with $2 million? I mean, me personally, I could. White Castle, I'd buy a White Castle. And then I could eat every night and have cramps. Okay? But you got the idea of, is that close enough to layman's terms? And I do know that there are companies that do this. The question I have in my mind, though, is that question, you're telling me that there's nothing you could find that would cost $2 million or something less than that would be above the marginal cost of capital? There's nothing out there? Well, apparently there are companies that, I guess it comes down to search cost. You could look and look and look and finally find maybe a couple of projects that were big payoff, you know, high ROI. But how much would it cost you to spend the time and the money to find those projects? So maybe they really aren't any that would be worth their while to dig up. And so, yeah, this $2 million, yeah, you might be able to find something to do with it, but it probably costs you too much to find that project and to negotiate the deals and all of that. So, yeah, there's going to be some residual there, and that goes to the shareholders. The danger, and I want to bring this one up again, the danger is that, first of all, from year to year, your net income is going to fluctuate, as well as your capital needs. What would happen if your income eases a little bit the next year, but you find a lot more great projects? Well, then you wouldn't have that residual there, and you'd have to tell your shareholders, well, I'm sorry, it sucks to be you. I can't do a dividend this year because we found so many great projects. Well, that's going to get some investors happy. Well, that'll mean that they'll take these projects and the company stock will grow, but it's going to piss off some investors who were counting on the dividend. Okay, so the residual theory does get applied, but not all that widely compared to other things. If I were to tell you what the biggest reason for dividends, I would say it actually is signal. For the plurality of companies that issue a dividend, issue it as a signal. And then, like I said, I don't discount it because I've seen these other reasons in the field. I've seen them. But they do not dominate like just a pure signal. A stable, nicely little growing dividend is a sign that the company is healthy and that it can afford to take care of its shareholders with a nice little dividend check every year. There's also another reason that's just come up. When I was up at First Trust Chicago last year, with the analysts there, what First Chicago Trust does is they put together these packages of stocks and bonds, stuff like that. And then these packages, they take them to brokers, thousands and thousands of brokers all over the country, and they say, all right, here's our products. Now, why don't you try to use these to sell to your own clients, you know, the clients of the brokerage house? We got this thing for older people, this thing for younger people, this thing for people who want to be a little more aggressive. They're essentially just like packages of securities pre-made so that the broker doesn't have to put some complex thing together. It's all right there, and they can sell it to their financial planners to sell to people. They can sell it to clients directly themselves and all that. Okay, what I found out was last year we were talking about how bad the yields on bonds are. Bonds suck, Used to be I could protect you in your old age. You give me $1 million. I could probably ensure that on $1 million I could safely get you $70,000 a year for the rest of your life. Now, these days, I probably couldn't safely promise you $30,000. I couldn't. Because bond yields are so low, they've become like a dog. You can't use them for fixed income reliance for a lot of people. So what this First Chicago was doing, they were creating a package that was like, it was like a bond. What they did was they would go through thousands and thousands of stocks. And they would first of all say, high dividend yield. Then they would say, always dividend paid. And then they would look for a couple of other factors. And then they take a, let's say they found 30 stocks. They had a very high dividend payout ratio, high dividend all the time. It always stayed the same or it was growing. And they would take these and they'd bundle them into a product. And then, if I am your financial planner, they'd say to me, here's something that acts like a bond. It pays a fixed income, but it is providing a hellaciously better yield than the coupon would on a bond. So instead of me saying, the only thing I can do for you is get you about $30,000 a year, maybe a 3% safe yield on your $1 million, I might be able to buy this product, $1 million of this product, and guarantee you you're $70,000, $80,000 a year in something that's not a bond, but it is a high-yield stock. And now that the company, now that there are companies that know that these products are very interesting to First Chicago and to the big dogs like that, you're seeing companies actually aiming at getting their dividends up, getting them stable so that they can say, hey, look at us. Maybe you guys at First Chicago should put our stock into one of those nice little products of yours. So that's beginning to show up. I don't know how strong it is yet, but I do know that it's actually a very attractive product as an alternative to a straight bond. A little riskier, though, I should mention. Let me say this. There are other kinds of dividends. There is a stock dividend. And then there is a stock split. Whatever you have heard, these are bullshit. Okay. I can give you a 4-ounce hamburger. Oh, wait. Tell you what. I'm going to cut that hamburger into 4 pieces. Here are 4 pieces of hamburger. Now, aren't you doing better? There's no difference. But in fact, there is a difference. That's a bad signal. It's really a bad signal. I can't give you a dividend, a cash dividend. But woman, I am going to give you 20% more stock in our company. Now, what are you going to do with that? First of all, what do you suppose is going to happen when I issue 20% more stock to every shareholder of the company? What's going to happen to the price of the stock? Buy. Oh, you woman are made for Wall Street. I'll have my lawyers talk to your lawyers. Okay, yeah, that's all that's going to happen. All you're doing is taking the 20% and you're just essentially just making more stock. If you look at the financial statement, the statement of retained earnings, what will happen is if I issue a 20% stock dividend, the additional paid in capital will go up by, well, that part which is the stock at par will go up by the par value times the number of extra shares that have been issued, and then the additional paid in capital will go up. But what will happen is the same amount that goes up in the paid in capital and the par value, that will go off the retained earnings at the bottom of the statement of retained earnings. And so at the bottom, after everything's said and done, it's a wash. Nothing has happened whatsoever. except that I have told you that I don't have any money for a stock, for a cash dividend. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to say, I like you. You're a good guy. You feel richer? I know, right? Yeah. It was like I knew years ago. I knew this woman. She wore spandex. She wore, as she got bigger and bigger, she bragged, I can still wear my spandex. Bitch, that's because, I mean, it's stretching. There's not more fabric there. It's just... Shut up. Okay. Now, if you go above 25%, we would call it a stock split, not a stock dividend. If you go, I mean, at some point, you're just pouring so much new stock out there into the market that it's literally like a split. Yeah. 25%. And I don't know if that's a rock solid number, but that's just the rule of thumb. You do something like, for example, for every 2 shares of stock you own, you will get 1 share of stock. That's called a stock split. And it's, in other words, it's a twofer. The amount of stock of this company out there in the market is going to go up by 50%. One thing that I should point out about this is there's one reason I've seen a couple of times for doing this. It goes back to the clientele effect. A company might want, see, if your price of your stock has gone up to, let's say, do you know what Google is selling for right now? Google stock? Huh? It's a little north of stupid. It's like $1,000. It's more than $1,000 a share, okay? Now, some companies don't want their stock to be $1,000 a share. Let me ask you, obviously, woman, are you going to buy a round lot of Google? No, at $1,000 a share, a round lot, 100 shares, would be an insanely big amount of money, $100,000. And remember what I said, you usually buy stock in round lots. There's an idea that some companies don't want their stock so high in price that it is out of the reach of common people. And I honestly do know that there are companies that are like that. I just mentioned that company. It would never want its stock price to go that high because then the kind of people it likes to have as shareholders would never be able to buy the stock. So one explanation, other than that you're just blowing smoke up your investors' butts, is that a stock split might be to bring your stock's price back down into a range where it was accessible to a clientele that was more desirable. See, if I've got a stock that's $1,000 a share, the only things that are going to own my stock are the very biggest money people on Wall Street and places like that, which means that I am nothing but the bitch of the suits, of those people who wear the fancy suits on the street. If I don't want that, I might be interested in saying, okay, I'm going to try to keep my stock price in a range. If it gets up to $100 a share, that's going to be a trigger. We're going to declare a 2-for-1 split. Just not because for any reason other than that'll bring us down to $50 a share. That's all we're doing it for. That's all we're doing it for is so that it's not so high that a typical personal investor or a small financial planner could not use this product in a portfolio. Use the security in a portfolio. That's actually a logical reason for a stock split. Not so much for a stock dividend, but if you're talking about those hardcore 2-for-1s, that's a reason. Go.
How does the stockholder make money then if everything stays low?
Doesn't. Oh, well, you mean if the stock price goes down, they own twice as many shares, so they're where they were before. So if Google stock is going to go up by 10%, it's going to go up by 10% whether you have 100 shares at $1,000 a share or 200 shares at $500 a share. You'll still have the same amount of money you're making. So the fact that it's double the number of shares at half the price isn't really going to affect anything about your potential earnings as an investor on it. And that's what you always think. Okay, they're doing a stock dividend or they're doing a stock split. Let's see why they're doing it. Let's see what their explanation is for doing this. And if you, and it's not that hard, trust that bullshit meter that you have inside you. If they're saying, we are doing this to add value to our investors' portfolios. If they say anything like that, you say, bullshit. No. If they're saying, we're doing this to bring our stock price down into line with a clientele of investors that we appreciate and we want to keep it in the range of those kinds of investors for the future, then you say, okay, that's an honest reason. If you're telling me I'm going to make more money because you split the stock, no. But if you tell me you're doing this because of management, investor management policy, standing investor management policy, there's a good reason. That's decent. That's an honest reason. But if someone tells you that it's for your benefit, you're going to make more money because you have twice as many shares of stock, oh, horse crap. It's like daylight savings time. Yeah, you cut off the bottom half of a blanket and sew it to the top, you've got a longer day. No, you don't. You've just got a blanket with a bunch of stitches in it that are going to itch like hell when you're trying to sleep at night. That's all I have for you. Go home.